This is Sean with Voices Levon, and I'm speaking with Dr. Peter Friend. And where are you located currently?
Oxford, UK.
Oxford, UK. So, well, what town were you born in?
I was born in London.
And what was the date?
It was in 1954.
And the birth date? What was your birth date?
5th of January.
5th of January. And what were your parents' names?
My parents' name were John and Jean Friend.
Okay. And I understand your father was a physician and your mother was the first female orthodontist in the UK. Is that right?
She, not the first female orthodontist, but she was, I think she was the first person, the first female to get the FDS. But she was an orthodontist. That was the main thing.
And was your father just a general practice physician, or what was his area?
No, he was a hospital physician. He was an internist.
Okay. Did your grandparents have history in the field, in the medical field?
No, none of my grandparents were in the medical field. My mother's family were all farmers.
Okay. So as you grew, I understand your brother also went into the same, well, not the exact same profession, but he also went into the medical industry in general. Is that right?
He's a scientist. He's a physicist rather than a physician.
Okay. So as you both grew, where did you go to call it elementary or grade school? And then if it's not called high school, but what would it be called there? And where did you go?
We went through private schools. Our main high school was at Rugby School. And then we both went to Cambridge University.
Okay. And when did you start to realize that you wanted to go into medicine? What were some of the first triggers that happened personally for you that inspired you?
I knew a little bit about medicine because I'd been brought up in a medical environment. And then I decided to consider medicine as a serious career choice in my mid-teens. So I guess 15, 16, something like that. I was deciding whether I should become a doctor. I knew that if I was going to become medical, I would become a surgeon. That was something I was clear about. And then when I got to Cambridge, I made the commitment.
So was there any particular moments that as you were growing up that really made you inspired to want to help in any particular manner? Was it like kind of drove you through one particular facet of medicine as you started studying?
Well, surgery was always what attracted me because I've always liked the sort of the concept of understanding how things work and fixing them. And surgery fits that very well. In fact, my other career choice, had it not been medicine, it would probably have been engineering. Surgery, if you like, is something which is fairly close to engineering in some respects. It's about understanding how bodies work and repairing them.
Okay.
But when I got to medical school, certainly I was very clear that this was going to be surgery.
And you had a very esteemed mentor, Sir Roy, and how do you pronounce his last name?
Khan.
Khan. Can you kind of describe how it was studying under him and kind of the first steps of how you got connected?
Well, he was my main mentor once I'd qualified as a doctor. When I started my surgical training, he was the chairman of surgery at Cambridge, which is where I did most of my postgraduate training. He is a very charismatic man. He was somebody for whom surgery and surgical innovation was completely central to his thinking. He was an original thinker. And he was totally motivated, totally focused. And he'd chosen to develop a new field in surgery, that's transplantation, which was difficult. And he was very much of the first generation. And so when I started to work for him as a very young junior trainee, I just found the whole thing very, I found him very charismatic, and I found the whole field very exciting.
And so working in, you know, what Leo provided was kind of forging the way within liver transplantation. So was that the kind of, let's say, the most difficult organs to be able to start with, or what was the reason that liver was kind of a primary focus?
Liver was a big focus in Cambridge because it was one of the very few, one of the relatively few places doing it. It was a technically difficult procedure, and one in which success came quite late. Roy Kahn was one of the three or four international pioneers in liver transplantation. He was the first person to carry out a liver transplant in Europe, or rather outside the United States. And by the time I was training with him, it was still a very, very much, not quite an experimental procedure, but it was a procedure which was carried out infrequently and with difficulty. So it was a challenge. It was a very challenging operation. It was not at all routine.
What are some of the aspects of it that, I guess, create more of a higher rejection rate, or that make it more difficult physically to?
It was technical. Patients are extremely sick.
Okay.
And the actual surgical procedure to remove and replace liver were right at the edge of what could be achieved, not just surgically, but in terms of the anaesthetic support and the intensive care support and the blood bank support and all aspects of supporting what has now become a very routine, relatively routine procedure. Back then, they were far from routine. They were right on the edge. And you know, part of the thing which Roy Kahn managed to do was to take people with him. You know, logic would have said, "Don't do this. It's too difficult. The results are too bad. It's not going to work." But he was driven to saying, "Yes, it's going to work. It's not going to be easy, but we're going to get there." And that, of course, is the mark of people who make a difference. They don't do things just because they've been done before. They do things because they haven't been done before,
right?
But because they're worth doing. And this was a very steep and dangerous mountain that he was climbing. But climb it he did.
So he was asked to come over to the U.S. to Indiana University, and did he send you in his place? Is that kind of the story?
No, he didn't. He was asked by the chairman of surgery at Indiana University if there were any trained liver transplant surgeons who might be interested in coming out to Indiana.
Okay.
And the reason, this was a bit later on, this was right at the end of my training, this was in 87, and I was just very, very close to the end of my training in surgery, and he asked Roy Kahn whether there was anyone who would be suitable. The chairman of surgery, the name was Jay Grossfeld, a very great man. And Roy Kahn suggested me. So that's when I went out to interview at Indiana.
So what was that like, going through your head thinking you were going to be coming over to the U.S. and be tied to Indiana? And what was kind of your thought process, and were you excited about it?
Flying into Indiana, it must have been, I think it was probably September 1987. And I remember flying in there, at the end of the summer, of course, and just looking at those big flat plains with Indiana coming in, you know, the city in the middle of what seemed like a very, very large open space. All I knew about Indianapolis, really, before I'd met Dr. Grossfeld, was the fact that there has the Indianapolis 500-mile race there every May.
Right.
So that was the reason why it was on my radar, and I have to say that made it rather an interesting prospect, but of course it's a very important and large university and a very major medical institution. So I rapidly discovered that it was a fantastic opportunity. So I interviewed there by a number of people. I remember it was all one day, It started at 7 a.m. and it finished with me getting on a plane sometime in the evening to fly to Pittsburgh. And I had interviews all day, meetings all day, including with Dr. McCarthy. And then I got a letter from the chairman not long afterwards saying that the offer was there, and could I let him know my response? So that was the process, the recruitment process, very efficient, met all the right people very rapidly.
So were you essentially the point person recruiting the team from within their staff to essentially accomplish what they brought you over there for? They put you as the head of this new division?
No, I was a very junior person, and okay. I joined an established team, but a team which was running a very large and successful kidney transplant program, okay. That was anxious to add liver transplantation to its portfolio. So I was rapidly embedded in a very functional team with a lot of support, and it was a very easy transition. I mean, it was a very interesting transition because, of course, working in the States is very different from working in the UK in terms of the way the healthcare works. And I had only ever worked in the NH in the National Health Service before, but I was extremely well supported. And given a lot of freedom to say how liver transplantation should be, and of course what I was doing was replicating what we had been doing in Cambridge, and I was given every support to do that. But it was in the context of an existing and highly functional transplant group. Right. So I was, as I say, I was technically quite a junior staff member. But given quite a high level of responsibility, which is a wonderful opportunity for me.
So you obviously were working with Leo because of him being connected to the blood bank as well as, with transfusion medicine in general.
Yes.
When you first met Leo, do you remember, was it that first day when you met everyone, or do you remember the first moment when you met Leo?
Yeah, I do remember him. He's a very memorable person. As I'm sure you know, he was one of the people that I was scheduled to meet when I came to interview, and he was extremely friendly. I mean, he's a very, very easy person to get on with, as I'm sure you know. Yep. Very, very interested in me, very interested in, not just what I was going to do as far as liver transplantation, but just interested in the bigger picture. And I remember it was a very, very enjoyable meeting, a very comfortable meeting, and a very extremely friendly meeting, which was fantastic. Because it's quite intimidating. I was a young surgeon, just coming to the end of my training. So I was quite inexperienced in the ways of these things. And so it's quite an intimidating process. Looking back on it, it must have been very intimidating, actually. And Leo was just wonderfully positive and friendly and nice.
So were you able to enjoy
I got the impression there was an ally there.
Were you able to have some experiences with Leo outside of, doing the job in Indianapolis?
When I got to Indiana, I mean, I didn't arrive until the following April.
Okay.
In 88. But yes, when he communicated with me in between times because he wanted to know what was wanted. He said, I need to know what a liver transplantation program is going to mean for the blood bank. And he wanted to be prepared. And when I arrived, he was prepared. There's no question. He'd done plenty of preparation, plenty of diligence. What I found was somebody who was, fantastically supportive. And I have to say, that's unusual. In those days, liver transplantation had a bad reputation for consuming a large amount of resource, particularly blood products.
Okay.
And it wasn't always very popular with blood transfusion services around the world, including where I'd come from. And what I found with Leo was that whatever the stress was that I managed to put on his service, he always regarded as being a challenge which could be met. There was never a moment when Leo said no. He always said yes. It was fantastic, and he was an extraordinarily supportive. He became a very close friend, as you know. But as a colleague, he was enormously supportive. It was all about solutions. It was never about problems, or rather, it was never about problems without solutions. He always came out with the solutions. And he sort of engaged with me, and he made sure that I knew the key members of his staff. So one thing I always knew was that there may be problems of all sorts in trying to get a new fledgling liver transplant program off the ground, but the blood bank side of things would always come up with it. It would always deliver. And that was a huge advantage.
So as far as you've already referenced the larger amount of blood that is used for a liver transfusion compared to other type of organ transfusions. So what's the main reason to the layman person that they can understand why it's a larger amount that's used? Is it because of the length of the surgery, or what's the situation?
Sure. Well, first I point out that it is no longer that way. The liver transplantation is no longer a sort of heart sink for blood transfusion services.
Okay.
Because the techniques have improved, the technology has improved. So a lot of liver transplants actually make relatively little demand on blood banks. But back then, it was different. And the reason is that the liver has got a very large blood supply, but patients in liver failure have very, very impaired ability to clot their blood. So when they bleed, they go on bleeding.
Okay.
And they also have a large number of abnormal blood vessels around the liver as a consequence of the scarring and damage to the liver. So there are channels that by which blood travels, which are a direct consequence of cirrhosis, of the liver disease. So you're trying to do a very big operation in an environment which is surrounded by very, very abnormal and unpredictable blood vessels under high pressure. So a lot of blood loss was very, very common. And we didn't have the technology back in those days, surgically, to control it the way we do now. And the patients were extremely sick, and so their ability to clot their blood and to survive these operations was quite severely impaired. So I can't remember exactly what the average blood losses were in those days, but liver transplantation was a major blood loss activity, and we didn't have the technology, also the same ready access to technology for recirculating blood and so on. So a lot of technical changes over the last 30 years.
So comparison percentages of people that had a successful acceptance rate then to now. Well, what would be the percentages of, you know?
I'd rather you didn't quote numbers, actually, because I can't remember. But you will be looking at sort of 75% success, whereas now you'll be looking at north of 90% success. And when I say success, I mean patients alive a year after the operation. I mean, if you're alive a year after the operation, you'll go on. You'll probably be fine. So it's the first year that you know that's when the success or failure happens, as it were.
What's the suggestion to the patient for the road to recovery as far as what they ingest and what they do?
So,
you know, once a patient goes through the surgery, what are some of the things that are suggested to them as far as lifestyle or type of things that they ingest, you know, as far as nutrition, or what are certain things that they do to help?
Yeah. Well, the first challenge is to survive the operation and not to die as a direct consequence of the operation,
right.
Not to die of infection. Then not for the liver not to fail because of rejection. And we didn't know the drugs we used for rejection were not as good then as they are now. And then there's these patients are hugely debilitated. They've been sick for years mostly. And it's the recovery, it's getting back some sort of condition, rebuilding muscles, rebuilding a sort of normal physiology. And that takes months or sometimes longer. These are very, very sick patients, right on the edge of survival, undergoing a very, very major surgery. So almost anything can go wrong. So it's a big challenge. The convalescence is a big challenge. But one which by the late 80s was beginning to work. It was by that stage, it was an approved therapeutic procedure, and the results were, you know, definitely improving, and it was definitely well worth doing. And medical centers across the US were all building up new programs, successful programs for liver transplantation, just as Indiana University was.
Were you asked to go to those universities at all to teach them what you were teaching at IU?
No, there were other programs in fairly similar states, actually. I mean, the longest standing program was in Pittsburgh, and that was a huge program. It's the world's largest program by far. But there were other programs which had been established. Most of the new programs were established during the 1980s. Indiana would have been reasonably typical in looking to start liver transplantation in the mid to late 1980s. Over the years, I've been to visit a large number of liver transplant programs in the US. And I have to say, one of the things which gives me greatest pride is that Indiana University is still one of the major liver transplant centers in the US. It's still a large, active, and well-respected program.
So you became the professor, or the first professor for transplantation medicine at Oxford, is that right?
I was the first professor of transplantation, that is correct, and there are plenty of transplant surgeons, and my immediate head of department when I was recruited was the overall chairman of surgery, and he was a transplant surgeon, but my chair was in transplantation specifically rather than in surgery. So that was a new position which was created, and I was the first person to occupy that chair. But I was not the first academic professor who was a transplant surgeon, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and you were the senior author on an article, landmark article, that was proving the difference between, from what Leo described to me, pumping blood through the organ as opposed to freezing the organ when you're transplanting the organ. If you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, my research for the last... Well, actually, my research for most of the last 30 years has been in something called isolated organ perfusion, which is maintaining an organ, in this case the liver, alive and functioning outside the body. And most of the work we've done has been using that as a way of preserving the organ in a functioning state. So at the moment, in fact, since the beginning of clinical organ transplantation, the period from when the organ is removed from its donor to being implanted into its recipient, which can be many hours, is normally achieved by cooling the organ down, by flushing it with special, what we call preservation solution, and then putting it at ice temperature. It's rather like putting meat into a refrigerator. It slows down the rate of deterioration of the tissue, but it doesn't stop it. So it continues to deteriorate, but more slowly, which is why it buys enough time to do the whole business of the transfer, the transport, and the re-implantation in the patient. What we hypothesized was that if instead of cooling it down, you put it onto an artificial circuit, so you essentially give it blood at normal body temperature with nutrients, with oxygen. In other words, you put it into an environment very similar to the one that it would have been if it stayed in its original patient, in its original owner. That should allow the organ to be preserved much more effectively because it doesn't get damaged by loss of oxygen supply, doesn't get damaged by being cooled down. It just continues to function. So not only should the preservation be better, but it should be possible to measure the function whilst it's being perfused to decide whether or not this is a good organ or not. So that's what we did. A lot of research work in the university, first in Cambridge and then in Oxford. And then we commercialized it. So we've got the university put money into converting this into a treatment, into a therapy. And the university actually spun out a company to do this, which I'm still involved with today. And the trial that you're mentioning was a paper which was published in Nature, the journal called Nature. And it was the results of a large multi-centre trial in Europe, a number of seven big liver transplant centres combined to test this new technology against the cold preservation, the ice box technology. And what it demonstrated was that the amount of damage sustained by the transplant was reduced by about 50%. That the number of organs which had to be discarded as being unusable was reduced by about 50%. And that the preservation time was increased by about 50%, roughly. And that was felt to be a very important paper, which is why it was accepted by the journal Nature. And that's the work we're still doing.
So if you could describe actually, the machine, or how it's hooked up to the liver itself, and was that patented? Was that part of what Oxford put the money behind?
Yes. You have to have something patented if you want to persuade venture capitalists to put some money into something. So that there was a patent owned by the university. And the patent was the way we replicate the control of the blood pressures and flows through the liver. The liver is a very complex organ because it's got all the blood coming from your intestine gets filtered through the liver. Now that's a big vein taking blood from all your intestines. When you are asleep doing nothing in the middle of the night, there's not much blood coming from your intestine. It's quiescent. It's just not doing anything. When you have a very large meal, a lot more blood comes through your intestine because it's busy doing what your intestine is supposed to do. And the blood supply goes up a lot. The liver has to deal with a very variable blood flow, but it has to deal with it without altering the pressure. So that's a very complex system of regulation. And we had to replicate that in the machine. And so the patent we filed, and this was more than just over 20 years ago we filed the patent, was how to do that in an artificial environment without making it so complicated that it was never going to happen. And it's a process we called auto-regulation. And that's the basis of our first patent. And that was the basis, therefore, for the spinning out of the company, the raising of quite a lot of money, and the production of the first clinical device. And that's the device which has just finished its investigational device trial in the States, actually. And Indiana University was one of the trial sites.
That's amazing. All right, so Leo also mentioned that you wanted me to bring up your first conversation with the head of transfusion medicine at Cambridge, and the first liver transplant that happened. If that makes sense to you?
Well, that was the first liver transplant at Cambridge was long before my time. But when I was a very junior doctor, we didn't used to have coordinators. You know, we now have lots of transplant coordinators that do all the organization of individual cases. Back in those days, it was the most junior doctor on the team that had to do all the organization, and we had to phone up the head of all the laboratories that were going to be involved, the head of the blood bank, the head of hematology, the head of biochemistry, the head of everything, the anesthesia, everyone had to be told. We had to organize the transplant. We had to do everything to organize the transplant. It was a big task. You had a big long list, and you start at the top of the list and you work your way down. And by the time you were halfway down your list, the people that you were phoning had already heard from somebody else that there was a liver transplant happening, because it was a big deal. And of course, they always wanted to know why they hadn't been phoned first. But you couldn't phone everyone first. You could only phone one person at a time. But I do remember phoning the head of the transfusion service, and I phoned up and I said, I'm just phoning you up to let you know that we're going to be doing a liver transplant tonight, and I went on to start to deliver the important details about the patient, and the head of the service stopped me and said, I just want to stop you there because you've made one mistake. You've told me that Professor Khan is going to be doing a liver transplant. You're wrong. He's going to be doing a liver transplant. He wants to do a liver transplant. It depends. And it depends on all sorts of very important variables, one of which is whether we can support it with enough blood. And it was just putting me in my place, because she was extremely helpful. And she came back to me very shortly afterwards saying, absolutely fine, we can support it, we've got enough blood, we have the provisions, you're okay to go ahead. But she wanted to make it quite clear to me as a very, very junior doctor, and she was perfectly polite about it, which was that it wasn't a given that the blood bank could support a liver transplant. It was something we hoped, it was something they normally managed to do, but it wasn't easy, and indeed it wasn't. And that was the anecdote that Leo's referring to, and that was of course very pertinent to him, because I knew that Leo always would support it, and I knew that just below the surface that a lot of people were paddling quite hard to make that work, but they always managed it.
And how many years have you been a professor with Oxford?
20
years. Are you?
Yeah.
How much longer?
Well, actually, 21.
How long is the road ahead of you?
Oh, not that long. they'll kick me out soon.
What are some of the major things you love about teaching at Oxford?
Well, Oxford is a great academic institution. It's a wonderful place. It's full of motivated, clever people, and it's full of people who want to collaborate. I mean, for example, I was just on a meeting this morning with one of my research fellows, one of my young surgeons doing research, doing a PhD with me, and we were meeting with the physiology department, and we just invented and agreed to do a collaboration looking at how effectively red cells release oxygen with varying degrees, periods of storage, because that really matters to us. We use red blood cells to carry oxygen in our circuit, and we use blood from the blood bank for that. And the question is, how well does it work, you know, right from the beginning? And the answer is, it's not normal. Blood doesn't carry oxygen or release oxygen normally the moment you give it to the patient. And so we're going to do a study to see how that affects our circuit. Now, that I mention that partly because it's of interest to Leo, because that's a study, that's the sort of experiment he would love. But partly because it just illustrates that two groups from completely different departments, the Department of Physiology and the Department of Surgery, can pick up a phone, have a meeting like we're having on Microsoft Teams right now, and agree to collaborate. Nobody mentioned money. We just agreed to do an experiment together. We'll sort out where the money's coming from later, you know, how it's going to happen. What we agreed was, this is really interesting, and it's interesting from two different directions, so let's just do it. And, you know, Oxford is like that, and I've seen that time and time again, lots and lots of opportunities to meet people who have skills that you've never dreamt of, and that together you can make something happen. And that's what universities are for. It's great.
So what are some of the goals in medicine that you have for the rest of your career, or do you think within your area that need to happen to progress it even further?
Well, on the research side, there's still considerable mileage in what we're doing with organ perfusion, because what we want to do is to lead this on to an environment where the things we do to organs in isolation, we can treat organs rather than just preserving them. We can actually treat them. We can make them better, we can repair them, and we can modify them so we can actually deliver treatment to an organ to make it better suited to the transplant that it's going to undergo. So, for example, can we modify an organ so it's less likely to reject? Can we modify an organ so it's less likely to have a bad reaction when it goes into the patient? You know, there's all sorts of things we can do, and we're just beginning to explore those now. So what I see in 5 years from now, or 10 years, we'll have a whole new, as it were, clinical science behind this business of treating isolated organs. And it may not even just be in transplantation. It may be different therapies, things we can do to organs when we've got them, as it were, isolated from the body. What can we do to treat organs to repair them? In all sorts of settings. So I think it's very exciting. And the nice thing is, this is a field which is growing outwards. It's not closing in, it's growing out. But it's a good place to be. So there's another lifetime's work there for someone.
All right, so
there's lots of enthusiasts.
When you left IU, Leo wanted to bring up the going away party. He said that he was one of the only gentlemen at the party, and you had a lot of female people that worked with you that supported you that were there.
Did he? I must have forgotten that. I mean, there were lots of very nice people, and I don't remember that. I don't remember any particular gender imbalance. If that's a recollection, I wouldn't want to disagree with him.
He said you're a very charismatic individual, that, and especially when you started in the program at the beginning to get the right people on board to be able to help what your mission was while you were here at IU.
I can't remember. What's he say?
He said a lot of positive things. All right, so he also wanted me to ask that how long, in comparison to when operations would happen back in the day, how long would those operations take place as far as time, and then how long the operations in comparison to now?
Well, I guess the liver transplant then was sort of 6 to 8 hours, something like that. They'd be a little bit quicker now, not hugely. I mean, it depends on the surgeon, actually. A very rapid liver transplant would be sort of between 3 and 4 hours, but a slow one is still, I mean, a long one is still a long one.
And
so it's still a big operation.
He also,
It's just an operation which is smoother and less of an adventure now than it was then. But it's still a big operation.
So when you had your first operation for a liver transplant at Indiana on a recovering alcoholic who had relapsed,
yeah,
and then you had to, yeah, do a second operation, if you could talk about that.
Well, we didn't retransplant her, actually, sadly. She was a wonderful, wonderful young black woman who'd had a very disadvantaged, she came from a very disadvantaged social background. She was a very good first choice, because she was familiar with risk. It's actually very interesting. When you start a new program, this was a big operation with substantial risks attached to it, and here was a center which had never done this before, with a young surgeon who came from a foreign country, and she had a logical response would be for her to say, "Look, I'd rather go somewhere else." And so we were completely honest with her. We told her all the facts, and she just said, "Fine, let's go for it." And that was a really helpful. And I thought about this a lot over the years, because I remember her as if it was yesterday. And she was a wonderful, wonderful individual. I was very, very, very fond of her in the way that one remembers certain patients in one's life, because she was so positive about it. And she I think it was because she was familiar with risk. I didn't realize how disadvantaged her background was until later, when her background started to become more problematic, actually. But I think actually coming from that sort of disadvantaged background makes you kind of not immune to risk, but you kind of take it in your stride. It was very, very interesting. So she did really well. I mean, we went through the operation. She made a completely uneventful recovery, and she was a brilliant first patient.
So if we're going to kind of talk about just Leo for a little bit, what are some of the things that as you've tracked his career, and you've had conversations with him of different things he's been focused on, what are some of the things that stood out to you that you admire, or projects that he worked on that you thought were very inventive or revolutionary for the industry?
Well, you're familiar with Leo's professional career, in a way that I'm probably not, because I didn't meet Leo until he was 50, but he's clearly somebody who's dedicated his life. He's a proper university academic. He's extraordinarily well informed. He made it his business to be on top of the academic literature in his field. There was nothing I could tell him about the blood transfusion requirements and implications in transplantation that he didn't know. He was extremely well informed. And as I mentioned to you earlier, once we made the decision that I was going to come to Indiana, we were going to start a liver transplant program, Leo was the one guy who was in touch on a regular basis, wanting to know exactly, wanting to make sure there was nothing he didn't know that would be useful. He was extraordinarily diligent, and that continued actually. And he was always sort of handing me preprints from papers published in specialist journals, that I might be interested in. He's just somebody who was interested in his field, very well informed, very much at the top of his game, very much interested in it. The other thing which is very striking, because I got to know Leo very well when I was there, we were very close friends, was just how loved he was by the people that he was responsible for. He ran this big blood transfusion service, and it was quite clear that every single person that worked there completely loved him, because he regarded them as a large extended family. He looked after everyone. That was his nature. He had very strong personal relationships with people that he had responsibility for. It was something you rarely see, actually. I think I've tried to adopt that myself, but not to the level that he did. Just so people know that you know who they are, you know what makes them tick, and that you kind of care about their well-being. He expressed that to a very, very high level. Very most unusual, actually.
So
very impressive.
Incomparable to others in the industry in the United States for what he's accomplished, how would you, I don't want to say rank, but how would you compare him to what you know of other top physicians that have been in his industry, and how much of a total impact do you think Leo's made in comparison to those other individuals you've heard of in the United States?
Well, I'm not the right person to ask, because I'm not a blood transfusion specialist. So I don't know what the sort of what other people have done. What I do know is that Leo could have been a source of problems for what I was trying to do in Indiana, and he wasn't. He was a source of solutions. Absolutely, he was. If I had to rank the people that were the strongest supporters for liver transplantation in Indiana, Leo would have been right at the top of that list, and that I think would have been a very unlikely scenario in most places. But I've not been through it, so I don't have any comparators, because I haven't done the same thing in other U.S. academic university institutions. So I don't know how he would compare in terms of his academic status. He's clearly been a big player. He's clearly got a curriculum vitae which is impressive. He's clearly also been a substantial philanthropist. He's clearly given a lot. He's given to a number of institutions, including, of course, particularly his own. But he's been a very generous man, and he's been very targeted. So that his generosity has been productive. It's actually led to things that are worthwhile, and I think that's another huge contribution. And again, you'll know more about that than I do, I suspect. But clearly, his generosity has been important, and it matters to him, and obviously, it matters very much to the institutions who've been the beneficiaries.
So, has he been able to come over and spend time with you in the UK?
I haven't seen him for quite a long time. We speak from time to time on the phone, but he has been, but not... Actually, he was over in the UK a couple of years ago in Edinburgh. He was receiving a nomination, but unfortunately it was a particular day when I couldn't get up to Scotland to join him, so that was most unfortunate. But yeah, we've met in the UK. And we've met in the States, so we keep in touch and we meet when we can. The last time I met him was, I suppose, a couple of two or three years ago. I can't remember exactly when it was now. But if I'm ever in the vicinity of Indianapolis, of course we meet.
Sure.
So we're due another meeting actually.
And you're able to meet Susan over the years, feel that.
Oh yeah, I got to know Susan very well. She's wonderful. She's completely wonderful, and I have to say I was completely thrilled when they got married. That was a great piece of information. And when he sent me the photograph of the event, and I was completely thrilled. She's very special, and lucky him.
Okay, so there's two more little things he wanted me to bring up. You playing tennis in Indianapolis on a hot summer day?
Yeah.
Does that ring a bell?
Well, I was never very good at tennis actually. I did play tennis, but I wasn't very good at it. But one of our mutual friends, a wonderful guy called Mike Forney, was a very good tennis player. So I would sometimes play tennis and be slightly humiliated. When Roy Kahn came to visit in Indianapolis, it was the middle of summer, and Roy Kahn was a very big tennis player. And the first thing he asked me when I collected him from the airport was, you know, where the tennis courts were. There were plenty of them. And he wanted me to arrange somebody. He was there for a few days with us, and he wanted me to arrange someone to play tennis with him every day, which I did. And he kept beating them. And so finally, I found out one of the other physicians was that I knew to be a very, very, very good tennis player. And I asked him if he would mind taking my boss to play tennis, and that he needed somebody to give him a sort of serious workout, and that is exactly what he did. So my boss was finally defeated on the tennis court, and I think that was what was needed. But I think he was very happy to have met somebody that could give him a really, really good hard game. But my own exploits on tennis I prefer to forget about, to tell you the truth, because I was never very good, and then I injured my back. I got a prolapsed intervertebral disc, and that was the end of my tennis playing. And that was 20 years ago. And I have to say, I was not too distraught to hang up my racket, because I was never very good with them.
He also said you love Porsches as well.
I still have a Porsche. Yes, I've had Porsches for 25 years, and. It may be less, not an entirely practical means of transport, but it's something which I like very much.
And what's the model that you have loved the most?
Well, I've had three different Porsches over the years. The current one is the Cayman S, which is the mid-engined coupe, and I think it is probably the best car they've ever made. It's the cheaper end of their range. But I just think it's a very sensible balance. I mean, sensible is probably the wrong word for a Porsche, but it is a Porsche you can live with every day, and indeed that's what I do.
So where has been the most beautiful road you've driven one of your cars on in your life?
Oh, the most fun I've ever had is not on a road, it's on a racing circuit. I've driven my Porsche many, many laps around Silverstone, around the Grand Prix circuit. And I can tell you, that is something else. That is brilliant.
Is there anything else on the bucket list as far as involving your Porsche?
I haven't done much recently, actually, but driving it on the track is definitely preferable. The other wonderful trip I had, we drove it down to Corsica one summer. We went on vacation in Corsica, which, as you know, is a big island off the south coast of France. We drove all the way down through France, then got the ferry across to Corsica. That was a wonderful drive.
Are there anything else in the medical world that you would like to accomplish as far as a bucket list, before you retire?
Well, I want to leave a legacy. I want to leave something behind in Oxford which has got lasting value, and that's obviously important. I would like to see the technology we've developed of fusing organs to make them work better. I would like to see that turn out to make a big difference to the whole business in transplantation, and we're just beginning to see that now, and I'd like that to become a success. I think I'll be happy with those.
And what would you like to say to Leo directly as we wrap this up?
Well, I would like to say to Leo that I remember him, think of him with great affection. He's a long-standing and close friend, and I owe him a great deal.
Okay. Well, just stay on the line for a second, but I'm going to close out the recording.